Welcome to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast with Julian Castelli. Each week, we talk with senior tech leaders to explore stories and insights about the challenges involved with growing technology companies. We hope that these stories can help you become a better leader and help you navigate your own growth journey.
Hello, this is Julian Castelli. I'm the host of the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast, where each week I talk with inspirational entrepreneurs and leaders in the tech industry. Past guests of this podcast have included CEOs and CXOs of great companies like Workfront, CHG Healthcare, Retica Systems, InMoment, RetailMeNot, the San Francisco 49ers, and many more. This episode is brought to you by Growth Elevated. Growth Elevated is a community of tech founders, CEOs, and CXOs who are committed to working together to share best practices and learnings in an effort to help all of us become better leaders. We do this through educational programs like this podcast, as well as our blog, and of course, our annual Tech Summit, which just so happens to be at the base of a beautiful ski mountains. We've been at Park City Mountain, Alta Resort, and I'm sure we're going to find even more exciting ones in the future. So if you like skiing, if you like growth, if you like peer mentorship, check out what we're doing at growthelevated.com. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and reach out and learn more about our community. Today, I'm super excited to be welcoming our guest, Rob Kaminsky. Rob is the co-founder of Fletch Product Market Management. It's a product marketing consultancy that's helped over 300 B2B startups figure out their positioning and translate it into clear messaging on their homepage. Rob has consulted with over 300 venture-backed startups to develop their positioning strategy. He also has created an internal incubator for a company that was acquired by Vista Private Equity Group, and he's designed over 50 surgical instruments for specialty spinal surgeries. So he has a deep knowledge in product expertise, and we are excited about having Rob on the program this morning. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so Rob, first of all, let me just shout out, I think you're probably the best utilization of LinkedIn that I've ever seen. And that's how we got to know each other. We were introduced by a friend. I saw your stuff on LinkedIn, and man, it just spoke to me. I worked with tech companies, I worked with SaaS companies, and a lot of them struggle with positioning. And it's almost like I just thought that, and your post started showing up in my feed, and it worked great. So first of all, kudos to what you guys are doing with product marketing on LinkedIn. It worked here, and I'm grateful that we got to know each other. And obviously we've worked together on a handful of portfolio companies, and you've done a great job. And so I'm excited about sharing the exciting expertise that you do with our broader audience today. How did you become such an expert on product marketing?
Yeah, well, for me, I've kind of done tours of duty around product and sales and marketing. And it was kind of funny, I ended up in a product marketing role at Oracle, but it wasn't actually called that. And so like this triad of like figuring out who do we focus on? How do we talk to them? What's the strategy to get after them? I had always seen that through like these different pockets of product marketing and sales. And now there's like this actual label to it in product marketing. And so I circuitously like found my way in the space. And then more specifically where I've actually spent the thousands of hours of what I would say like focused in product marketing is when I met my co-founder really about 3.5 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, where we were working for a digital product studio. And we effectively were just helping a lot of startups figure out what to build it, how to get to market. And it's spending thousands of hours looking at companies and helping them do that. That's kind of brought us up to today. And I would say maybe 2.5 years ago is when we had this real shift of like, let's just focus here. No one knows what the heck positioning is. Everyone's got a different definition. What's in a value prop? And we saw these as like, there's a gap. Like if we can't even speak the same language as practitioners and consultants and advisors, like what are we doing? We're just making stuff up. And so that drove us down this path where we've basically been obsessed with what is product marketing? What is positioning? What does good look like? What does bad look like? And how do you build it up and break it down to actually work for these early stage and growth stage startups? And so that's been probably more of a 4-year journey for us now, specifically in the space.
I love that. And I love the fact that you identified it and decided to really focus, which of course mirrors your advice to clients, which is really neat. But give us a little bit more. Like what were some of the mistakes you were seeing that over and over again that made you give you the confidence that this was a rich enough mine to invest in digging onto it?
Yeah, so it was kind of this perfect storm of signals for us. So again, for context, we were at this digital product studio, and think of us, we were basically getting dropped into these early stage startups as fractional product and marketing leaders. And so having that exposure, what we realized is like, geez, there's so much variety for ourselves, like just in selling strategy services. And so part of the task we had when we weren't in projects is like, hey, how do we position product strategy as a service?
Yeah.
And we're like, well, and we went deep on that and we tried a bunch of experiments. And what we realized very quickly is like being broad, it's just, it doesn't work. There's nothing repeatable about it. And then simultaneously, because we were targeting early stage startups, we started reading thousands of startup homepages just as part of our prospecting process.
Right.
And we noticed this thing. We're like, we can't tell what any of these companies do, let alone who they're for. And we're like, is anybody else seeing this? Like, we were kind of blown away. And we started writing about that. And so like the signal there was like, we just thought this was silly. We started writing about it. And this lack of focus, this lack of clarity around how people talk about themselves, what markets they're going after. And that struck a nerve, like on LinkedIn. We just sharing our thoughts, we were going deep. And that's what just pulled us down the rabbit hole, so to speak, is just finding this interesting problem that we were bumping into anyway with clients. Because like when you're starting to build a go-to-market program from scratch or layer on additional programs, there was always this really difficult tension between big TAM and then really quality execution and quality content. And when you look and you trace that back to the core, it all comes back to really broad definitions of your ideal customer, really vague definitions of what the product does, usually because it can do so many different things. And it's in that problem where we've just spent the past few years. I think it drives.
I'm going to ask you to give us, sorry to put you on the spot, but do you have any examples, right? Because I know what you're talking about because we've worked on some together and I've read your LinkedIns, but like the vague big problem that the founder thinks is clear to the audience, but it's just not. Give us an example or two so our audience could really zero in on what we're talking about.
Yeah, for sure. So we worked with a company, I believe I can say their name. They're a venture back group called Maxa, and they're going after the enterprise. They basically have an AI product that is sort of like an analytics tool. And that's how they were initially positioning it. They're like, hey, we're an analytics
tool. Sort of like an analytics tool.
Yeah. And they're like, it's for the enterprise, it's for finance. And then, but then you ask the question of like, well, what would they use it to do? And the answer is kind of like, well, anything. And it's like, okay, great. Like therein lies the rub. And so like, and here's like specifically what happens, especially for venture-backed companies doing these really innovative things that can be used in a lot of different ways. The vision for this company, like their technology is really impressive. As you imagine, it's using AI.
Right, it's very
dynamic. And so like as an early adopter or a technology enthusiast, you'd look at it and be like, wow, this is incredible. Like, I don't even really know what we'll use it for, but I need this. And then
we know it's exciting. We know it's new, but yes.
Yeah.
That's a concept, not a product, right?
Yes, but for part of the market, right? And so this is a story like as old as time in terms of startups, is like new technology creates this, like in this case, Max's product, this visionary analytics tool for finance. There's a part of the market that sees that and goes, this is a game changer.
The early adopters probably, right?
Yes. And it's a combination of two roles. Usually there's like technology enthusiasts, the folks that are under the hood that are like, whoa, how's this thing work? This is freaking cool. And then there's these very visionary, usually executive leaders, very forward-thinking folks. And they're not looking necessarily for products to plug into workflows. They're looking for game changers in the way that they're going to operate and get ahead of their competition. And so what happens is they see these products. And so like, and this is a true story from Maxa. It was a golf course sale, big sale for them early on, where they connected to a really high executive. I want to say it was Mercedes. I could be off on that. So don't quote me on that later. But they saw the product. And they're like, wow, this is it. I want to do a big pilot. So it's like a multi-million dollar deal. They didn't even know exactly what they were going to use it for, right? Because these visionaries, they're going to shoulder all that risk. They're like, let me just bring you in. I'll figure out how to do it.
And they're coming with a problem. They're coming with a problem. They're searching for a solution and they're willing to do the work to make it fit, right?
Yes. And I might even challenge, again, they might not even know the problem. They just see like, this thing has so much potential. We got to get our hands on it. We got to start doing something. And it's very risky because they don't have the definition of the problem. And then eventually, like the ones that succeed is like, you partner with them. And then over the course of 18 months to 36 months, like you find something very valuable. And that acts as this like flagship case study for you to then go to these other executives and like, hey, did you see what we did for Mercedes? But they have to be very future forward, very like risk taking. And what most of these companies bump into is that the majority of markets are not risk takers.
That's right.
And so what happens, we see with startups, usually the venture-backed, visionary product built on a new technology. They share the vision with tech adopters that are like, this thing's freaking cool. Just give me it. I don't care how buggy it is. Then they get this visionary leader to buy a huge project. They're like, I don't care. I'll shoulder all the risk. And then the investors invest more. And the thesis is then we just got to keep sharing our vision.
Let's just find 10 of those, 10 more of those, but that's much harder.
But it's a wall, right? And even if they find five or six of them, and at this point, they might be a really good sized business, $10 million, $20 million. But then they think they can just keep sharing the vision. And then here's what happens. No one, these laggards, very pragmatic folks in the rest of the market, don't give a shit about the vision. And so they hear this thing and they're like, but what would I do it, like use it for? And it's like, you know, well, it could be this, this, or this. And then they ask the question of like, well, who's done this before? It's like, well, we've got like three companies using it in this way. And they're like, okay, come back to me when you have 30. Like they don't want to shoulder the risk. They're like, they want this thing to be bulletproof. And there's this gap. This is the whole thing that Jeffrey Moore
crossing the chasm. There we go.
100%. Yeah. Like he's written about this at length and we've just seen it play out in front of ourselves. So like bringing this back to your question of like, where does this challenge happen? It happens in really two things that we can go deep in is this very vague definition of your target market because it assumes you can go broad across all these use cases. And the fact that these markets are just very fragmented in terms of the tools that are being used, the workflows that are being carried out. And that nuance usually just gets oftentimes ignored. There's a lot of smart founders that kind of know this stuff, but they don't lean into that and recognizing, hey, I can't just sit at this high level and go to market as like a better way to do finance. It's too freaking broad. Where the devil's in the details. And that's what we see, we bump into and what we try and address.
Okay, that is awesome. I'm gonna ask you for like a Family Feud style, top five reasons you might be, you know, going too broad or need to narrow in your product messaging and marketing. How do you diagnose if someone has this problem? What would be the number one symptom that you see in your work?
Yeah, where it shows up as a symptom is usually when we look across their current customer base and we start asking questions of like, how are they using the product? What are they using it for? And when you start to get this picture of like, you have 50 customers, it's being used 32 different ways where there's just no thematic like through line. And when we see that, we're like, hey, you're effectively building like, and in our view, we were coming out of the agency world, like you're building a full service agency, a full service platform, which like, okay, fine. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no rocket scale on that because of what we see through a product marketer's lens. Well, if you were to go and activate all of those different positionings and go-to-market programs, that's 32 different go-to-market programs. And so at a surface level, it's like, how are people even using it?
Yeah.
How did they find you? Yeah, you just can't scale. And on top of that, it's like, it's just chaos. Like if you've ever been in those businesses and startups are chaotic, but like, especially when you go too broad.
Mixed blessing when the next client comes in because everyone's got to stop what they're doing and build something new.
Yeah. And this, I think this ends up creating, this is another thing we probably won't get into. It creates a big divide between sales and ops, I think, for a lot of startups where like sales, like, yeah, get a sales guy in front of someone. They're going to, if they're good, they're going to ask good questions. They're going to follow the rabbit holes and they're going to sell something. Great. But does the product do it? And then who supports it? Where like you get to this critical point where suddenly you've outkicked your coverage. You've sold more than what the product can do. And then you have some hard decisions to make. Do you hire to cover that? But then there's nothing repeatable to where when the sales stop and it just creates all this operational chaos when this happens. So that's like, that's a big
one. So that's number one, not a common use case. What are some other or clues that you might have a challenge here?
Yeah. The second one we kind of already hit on is like over relying on vision, because from a positioning standpoint, when you're doing a vision messaging that can do anything, what you're doing, and this is very conceptual, is you're almost positioning on a business outcome of like, hey, this is going to get you more revenue, or this is going to change the way you do things. Very abstract notions.
Right.
And when you look at this through a positioning lens, the question is then, hey, through the lens of this customer, what are you competing with to increase revenue? And the reality is, well, guess what?
Thousands of ideas.
Now you compete with everything, and we're going way beyond just software tools. You're competing with hiring people and training programs and bringing on consultants and adopting a new playbook, different methodologies. And it's like, you can't compete with all of that. You're going to be white noise at that level. And so that's the other one, like vision component.
Yeah. If you position as we are the P&L solution, competing with every potential P&L solution. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
And underneath the hood of this goes like beyond like the causes is like, there's a difference between marketing and sales. Market the product use case and what you're competing with, sell the outcome. So like we have, in B2B, we have just gone off the deep end on this outcome thing of sell the outcome, that we've let it overtake all of our messaging, where if you go to any average B2B SaaS, you're going to see some stuff about revenue. And it's like,
that's right.
We get it. Like, people are buying beyond
ROI,
the product.
ROI yes. got its place. Let's double click on that. Cause you know, there are good lessons out there about using ROI in the sales cycle. And is your point to get it out of the product marketing and into the sales process? Is that the appropriate place for it?
100%. And think about, like, any leader who's listening to this, think about the emails you get outbound to yourself, and how many say, wouldn't it be great to increase your revenue? What if I could get you 30 leads every month? Like, they're talking about these outcomes, but they
get you a 4x ROI, but with what?
It means nothing. And so, like, the best, and this is like the connecting the dots on those folks, like, assuming you can get me 40 extra meetings a month with my ICP, you have to hit me with something I'm struggling with now relative to that. Of like, hey, do I have a volume issue or do I have a quality issue? And what tools am I using? It's like, hey, Rob, I see you're using LinkedIn to get all this stuff. Like, have you ever thought about this? Like, that wedges into more my situation. That's good product marketing. And if I buy into that, then you can walk me to the ROI and all the things that you can actually do.
So you're talking about being very, very wide and trying to get narrower and narrower and narrower. Is that the big theme?
100%. And it's so counterintuitive. Like, this conversation, this question you just brought up, Julian, is probably the crux of what we're giving therapy on to founders that come to us, because they all say
all
the same thing.
Too.
They just say, I don't want to pigeonhole myself. And what they don't realize is, like, and again, it's so counterintuitive, the more narrow you go, the stronger your positioning and the better your marketing and sales programs are actually going to work. And so what we try and do is we try and walk them off the ledge of, like, hey, like, we know you want to be a $1 billion company. But where are you today? And most of the companies we work with, they fall somewhere between, like, I don't know, 500K and maybe 10 million, 20 million. That's kind of like some version of our sweet spot.
Yeah.
And so, like, let's say they're doing 5 million. We say, okay, the goal isn't what's your $100 million positioning. It's what's your positioning to get you to 10 or 15.
Right.
And when you realize that, you then go, oh, we can narrow. And the other thing that drives this is the question we always ask. We go, okay, great. How big's your go-to-market team? How many marketers you got? And we always hear, well, I've got like 2 people. I do it a little bit part-time. And we're just like, hey, like, rule of thumb loosely is, like, you need 2 dedicated people focused on one very narrow segment for 6 to 24 months to even get the thing working. They have to show up every day and keep hitting this. So you're telling me you think you can go after 10 segments with 2.5 marketers? It's like, I mean, hey, you can do it. You can write the page. But what we do in our work is, like, we're just using the page as a heuristic for, like, what are your programs going to be underneath the hood of all these things? And once they hear that, they go, oh, yeah, I'm kidding myself. And the only exception I will say to this is you can do that multi-segment approach, ultimately leading to broad, if you have a distribution advantage. And the type of distribution advantages we see are, like, do you actually have a product-led growth flywheel? Where when someone uses it, more people can use it. Like, think Calendly, think Loom. We're like, yeah,
right.
They can be in multiple places at once. Or do you have a strong partner network or some other thing? But if it's just your small team knocking on doors and trying to do marketing, like, that's not a thing. Like, building your distribution is going to be the biggest blocker to that.
Yeah, that makes great sense. And yeah, looking at those companies that have a distribution advantage could disillusion you or make you have a false hope that you can do that too. Talk to me a little bit about the challenge that founders have, like, because they do have to sell big and broad when they're talking to VCs and they're talking to their funders.
Yep.
And does that spill over into the product discussions and lead to some common mistakes?
It does, yeah. So a story comes to mind. There's a founder, a great founder. He's actually making a lot of traction at a company called 1UP. He had this scenario where he was early stage doing a couple million, but he wanted to raise again. And he's like, I've got this conundrum. VCs come to my site and then don't think I'm big enough for worth the investment. Like, do I talk to them? Do I talk to customers? Our thesis on this is your marketing assets should talk to your customers. Your pitch deck should talk to your VCs, and they should be truly separate. The only place they converge maybe is, like, your about page, your company info page, where you can talk to the broad piece. And this, I would challenge VCs, like, any VC worth their salt should understand that if you're only doing 5 or 10 million, you shouldn't be going to market like a $1 billion company. And so, like, and think about the slide deck design for your VCs.
Right.
You should be able to connect, hey, vision, huge TAM, 50 use cases. This is going to be great. But then I better see a go-to-market positioning slide of, like, hey, We know that's not reality. Here's what we're going to do. We are going to penetrate into the market this way and then scale into these adjacent markets, like true beachhead style, unless there is, again, some distribution piece. But I expect to see that. And I see a lot of pitch decks as well, not even in there. And so these are the founders that are like, they just think that what I tell my VC is what I'm going to tell my customers. And it goes back to that whole vision thing. I'm like, well, that's how I got my first 10 customers. Don't I just keep doing that? And you know, you either get it or you don't. If you don't, you're going to get bit by it to then address it and eventually come to someone like you or me to figure it out. Or you get it up front and you get to educate your VCs. And they love that. Like really good VCs that I know.
Yeah, right.
They love the reality of like, you're not going to kid yourself, right? Like they're buying into the hype. You know, bad VCs are the ones that are just like, yeah, how are you going to, you know, they just ask the question, how's this going to be $1 billion? Good question. But like, what are you going to do next month? Yeah. Is the next follow-up.
How do you go from 3 to 10?
Yeah.
Or 10 to 30? Well, that's awesome. So what is good positioning look like? How do you answer that question?
So there's two parts to this. I'll hit the objection first that we get from a lot of the founders we work with. We get this question, how do I know my positioning is going to work? And here's the thing, you don't, right? It's like the analogy in my head is like positioning is this long-term bet. And we love the phrasing of bet because it implies the risk. Like we can't see around corners. So it's more of a conviction of like, how are you going to steer the boat? And using that boat analogy, it's like when you're doing a startup, it's like you've been dropped in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and you have to go find land before you die. And so your options right. are like, okay,
I like that analogy.
That's do great. I paddle east and try and hit the States, California? Do I paddle west and try and hit Japan or China? And like what these founders think they can do is like, all right, position me, we're going to go east. And they paddle for 3 days and go, is it working? And it's like, I don't know. We're still in the middle of the freaking ocean. Like it's something you have to commit to overall. And so that's one of these things. And so when you ask what good looks like, it's good if it can actually help you create working go-to-market programs and content that resonates. And so that's a qualitative sort of response to this. But like positioning is a tool that has two key things. It acts as like this beacon internally of like, that's where we're paddling. And it lets this segment you're going after know that's what we do. And so usually good is specific because that's where the differentiation shines. But to be candid, it comes in a lot of, there's a spectrum of good. And then we start to get into things of just pure execution. Is the product any good, right? Like I can come up with a killer positioning and saying this great thing, but if the product doesn't deliver, you're then going to have this negative hit on your positioning and recognition when people say, hey, they say they do this thing, but they don't. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's this multifaceted, multivariable thing. But foundationally, when I look at the elements, really great positioning has a very clear definition of your ideal customer, a very clear definition of the competitive alternative you're bumping into, the problem they're facing in that competitive alternative, and then a clear message of why you're better than the alternative. Like right. Those three components are the crux of any good positioning, really any valid positioning.
I like those definitional pieces. I'm going to share a story on how one of the clients that we worked on together defined how they knew that this was positive. So they had been going to trade shows for years, and the CEO used to go because he knew he had to explain the inevitable questions like, what do you guys do? You know, explain this to me again. And so he'd spend so much time. He had his whole routine where he would explain how they do this and they do this and all these different things. And then after we engaged with you guys and he had a one pager and he said, Julian, this was amazing. For the first time in 5 years going to trade shows, people didn't come up and say, hey, what do you guys do? They come up and said, can you really do this? And how much does it cost? So from what do you do or how does this work or what kind of company you are were the first sets of questions. And then afterwards it was, can you really do this? How much does it cost? So he felt like he had just accelerated through the diaspora of complexity that, you know, where we maybe get maybe 50 or 30% through to the other side. If they weren't too exhausted at that point, they might talk about price and execution to people with that one pager were ready to go and they were trying to solve a problem. And not only that, he recognized that the people who didn't have that problem, he wasn't wasting his time with them. So everyone who came up with that page in their hand was super excited because the messaging had already helped them understand what they do and how they might be able to help them. As they were coming, they're interested in solving their problem and they were going right to tactics.
Yep.
Did you see, is that common? Do you see that a lot?
100%. What you triggered for me, the other thing, and in this case, I know who you're talking about. So it's like what usually happens when we work with these groups is like, it's not that they don't know. It's that they know too much. And so whenever they start to communicate the positioning, turn it into messaging, whenever asked that, there's this tendency to pack in everything. Here's your situation. 100%. Here's the problem. Here's why it's bad. Here's why it's important. Here's what's going on in the industry.
Here's how we got here. Let me tell you my story, my corporate arc.
Oh, and no one cares. It's awful to where you're just like, you get in these monologue founders where you're just, your eyes glaze over and you're like, all right, okay, great. Nice meeting you. And like, you know, you politely exit.
Your opening store closes halfway through the conversation.
Yes, for sure. And so like what we coach on too, when we develop these positionings is like, hey, you have to recognize that the positioning is kind of just the way of explaining your product and like what it's for and why it's better. Great. That's pretty simple. It's going to have implications of what you say up funnel and down funnel. But this is where sequencing and journeys really matters. And so like, take my business, for example, we help companies with their positioning and then we translate it and document it on the homepage. Great. There are tons of problems and point of views and things we talk about. You won't find it in my elevator pitch. It's like, it's coming out in this conversation a little bit now, but like, this is part of the marketing of like, yeah, founders have terrible definitions of their ICP and like they over message and they're going too broad and all these things. That's me really educating and more positioning my expertise on the problem. Until I get someone to buy into some of my thoughts and perspectives on their situation and that problem, they're not even ready to hear about my product or service. And this is what gets a ton of founders like bent around the axle. It's like, they're just trying to like sell in one swoop. And it's like, stop, like get some credibility, make some connections, get them to understand what you do. If they buy into what you do, they're going to have questions. Take them further on the demo, then talk about the outcomes and ROI and try and close. But it's a journey. And like, that's just another thing we see all the time is they know it and they cram it in. We call it the curse of knowledge.
I can see that. They know so much and they want to share it and they can't help themselves. But yeah, you can see the window of curiosity from the client closing the more they're buried with context and data and stories and history.
With a VP of sales early in my career, and I was in sales, and my version of having this, I was a sales engineer once upon a time, was I thought I was really smart. I knew all this stuff. I was an textbook over-explainer. Like everything I just said was me. And this VP of sales was fantastic. His name's Ross Bernstein, taught me a lot about sales. He's just like, I'll never forget the moment. He pulled me aside after one of our sessions we had live. He's like, Rob, when they ask a question, give them a short answer. And then he said, and shut the fuck up. Like, I was just, and it like, it just stuck with me. Like, and he explained it. And then I started doing it. And naturally what happened then is it allowed for a back and forth of like, I'd answer, then they'd have another one rather than me just lecturing. And like, that's the analogy of just what I see with founders in their marketing and their elevator pitches.
I love it. STFP. It's also like, it's as stark a lesson as don't talk past the close, right?
Yes.
You just got so much you want to keep going. Right?
And we all do it.
Yeah. I love it. Well, hey, listen, so tell me, so this week we've defined the problem. It's out there, it's common. And I want to hear two things. I want to hear, you know, how you guys decided to narrow in yourselves, because I think you guys are really good about that. And then let's tell our audience how you solve the problem.
Yeah. So for us, as we were developing this thesis, we knew specific was the way. And so keep in mind, when we built our business, we were actually inside of another agency. And so this project for us was sort of like, hey, I'm on the bench. I'm not working with startups, like in between engagements. How do we get more startups to work with us? And we knew specific was the way. And in our minds, you either have to get really specific on industry or really specific on like workflow and asset for them to like deliver so you can get hyper clear. Ideally, you're doing a bit of both. Mm-hmm. And so we ran some like tests in a couple different ways, and maybe we can get into those. It started to work, except when you're specific, as you might imagine, you can't sell everything. And so the CEOs that we were partnering with on this were like, what do you like? This is only a few thousand bucks, like engagements. Like we've got developers, designers, all these other services. And like the reality is we were telling them of like, hey, this is like a land and expand thing. Cause they just didn't see it. They're like, are you going to do 100 of these a year? Like it just doesn't add up. And in our minds, we're kind of like, yeah, it becomes repeatable.
Repeatable.
And so like, but what was really happening to force the niching down, it happened through our content first. And so when we started, we were talking about product strategy and just like stuff.
Right. That's big
surface area. Yeah. And it's like, okay, you know, no, very low engagement. And then eventually like, you know, we get to something specific, start talking about product marketing. And then like, okay, the engagement went up a little bit. Like, okay, but still super broad and we're low engagement. And then we started talking about positioning and messaging, got a little better. Mm-hmm. And then we started talking about positioning and messaging for B2B and it got a little better. And then we started talking about positioning and messaging for horizontal B2B companies and then horizontal B2B PLG companies. And what we found is every time we ticked down, getting sharper into a scenario, LinkedIn engagement went up, founder DMs to me on LinkedIn went up and they're like, oh my God, that's me. And so, like, again, counterintuitive just from a pure, like, hey, we're writing about things that we're learning and who we're working with. And so it was just validating this thesis of, like, really focus. And there's a lot of stuff out there. There's a concept called the five ones in terms in the service world, where it's like one avatar, one product, one channel, one tactic, 1 year. And we were, like, loosely following that as a construct. But in the beginning, and this will relate for a lot of early stage startups, we were trying a lot of different stuff. Like, founders, because we were so all over the place. We did some pricing projects. We did some product onboarding stuff. We did some product road mapping. We did these product marketing and messaging things. But we were very mindful of, like, where is there going to be a theme? Where's their consistency to double down? And so as our LinkedIn stuff was really starting to work, we had solved kind of for distribution. Like, I was able to get in front of founders, probably 15 founders a week each. And so me and my co-founder, Anthony, we literally, like, by the hour, we're testing out different almost pitches of, like, hey, yeah, we do this. We're a pricing expert. And, like, you know, we're selling it before we even built the thing. And then when we sold one, we're like, all right, I guess we better go build this. And we were literally just checking in with each other, like, once an hour of, like, hey, what worked? What resonated? What didn't? And we did that for maybe 2 months. Again, hundreds of calls. And the themes were just this positioning and messaging thing. It just kept coming up. And we're like, all right, let's just focus on that. Threw out everything else, started writing about that. And then that took us down this, what is now, like, an over 2 year journey. And we've had to keep refining. And there's a lot of learnings along the way. But, like, I'll pause there. But that was loosely, like, start broad, throw a bunch of stuff at a wall, be mindful to listen for focus. And we just knew, like, and this was just a principle. Like, we knew we can't do multiple things because we were living inside of a digital product studio that was trying to do everything. Right. And it was a really chaotic scenario. And we're like, we just don't want to do that. And so anytime a new, I'll pause there. And then I have a funny follow-up that we use to, like, keep ourselves from chasing these silver coins, these new product ideas in these new markets.
Yeah. So you had the blessing of necessity that was focusing you there. What was your slogan or whatever that pointed you that might be memorable?
What do you mean by slogan?
You just said you had something you wanted to share that kind of forced you
to stay focused. As we were making progress, what kept happening, so, like, we got our first 10 or 20 customers, 30 customers, we would do this positioning and messaging thing and basically create this credibility of, like, building, like, the strategy of go to market. And then these founders would be like, hey, can you do a sales deck? Can you help me with onboarding? Like, all the things that we do in our other job. Yeah. And the temptation, and this is where a lot of founders get stuck, they take the money. They go, oh, yeah,
money. Of course we can. Yes.
And we were just like, no. And so this heuristic we had, number one, having a partner is key. Just a challenge on this. Because anytime one of us got excited of, like, we should go do this thing, these onboarding flows, like, it's a whole other way to make money, like, all that. The other person
pull you back in.
Well, the running joke was like, well, that's product number 13. And it started as like, well, that's product number two. We don't want to do product number two. And I kid you not, hundreds of ideas. Like, people ask us to do all this stuff that any of it could work. Where now we have this funny running joke where, like, when we want to go do something, product number 67. And it's just our way of saying, that's cool. Okay, so let's stay focused. Yeah.
I love it. And you guys do a great job of that. And that's, like I said, why your content resonates so well. Let's walk through. So I'm a founder. I'm guilty. I'm too broad. I'm confused between my investor messaging and my customer messaging. And so I've come to you and said, okay, I hear this. I need some help. How does it work? How do you work with a startup company, and how long does it take? What do you do?
Love this. So the first thing we do is we look at what they're doing now. We basically do what we call a positioning audit. So we review their whole site, their sales deck. We actually try and get a call of them demoing the product, because founders do pretty good in, like, a 30, 45 minute session. Like, they eventually do get it across of what they do.
Right.
They just can't do it in 30 seconds. And what we do is we use our model and our framework to really map out, like, hey, what are all the markets you're in? And the way we look at markets is through a workflow lens. And so, like, think workflow, use case, activity, job to be done. Like, this is our lens into markets in B2B, because B2B software, in our view, is workflow software. Like, you're helping people carry out a process. And so some of those are broad, some of those are specific. We have a way of mapping those. And so we map all of this out, and then we look at the product and their interpretation of, like, hey, this is what makes it really good. And as you can imagine, for all these different markets, there's different value props, all these things. We basically take this chaotic blob of how they're showing up in all these different ways. We organize it into our framework and think, like, very tactical rows with elements of, like, hey, here's your definition of target audience. Here's your differentiation. Here's the alternatives you're competing with. And here's the value. And we end up with these, what we call positioning options. And we say, hey, today, this is kind of the markets you're in. And then what we do is we evaluate with them, like, you can position for any of these. You have different levels of differentiation, different levels of competition, different sizes of these markets. And we start to look at things like, where are you at? How many resources do you have? What's your revenue today? Where are you trying to get? What's the goal with this whole thing in general? Where really is there an opportunity? Where's there a problem with one of these alternatives where there's just a gap? And we walk them through it. And I think the thing for us that some founders don't get immediately is we're not market whisperers. Like, we're not trying to be experts in any market or any space. Like, we think that's pretty ignorant of some agencies that say, yeah, I'll help you get customers and do all this. It's like, no, you've been working on this problem maybe for up to 5-10 years. Me in 5 days isn't going to get you there. What we can do is just visualize the strategies. And once you have them visual and you see it now as a tactical choice that has implications, that's where all the value is unlocked. Because what usually happens is these founders, they know the situations. They just can't clearly articulate which one's a bet and which one's not. And so they never make a decision. And so they move along doing 10 things at once. And so anyway, that's basically our first part of the process, audit. And we walk them through that in a workshop, make it visual. And we guide them to make a choice. And it is their choice. This is the strategy. This is the audience I'm going after. That's the strategy I want to take. And then once we have that, we move into a messaging exercise where we unpack, hey, what are the supporting arguments of going after the market this way? And then once we have that, copywriting. Let's translate it into an asset that acts as the centerpiece for both you and your teams, as well as your customers. And so it's kind of a three-step process where, like, sure, we deliver copy and messaging on a homepage. We see it more as the documentation of the positioning strategy. And so we reverse engineer it of, like, let's solve for positioning first, then let's solve for messaging, and then let's worry about this asset that you're going to use to communicate with your teams and your customers.
And if I recall that you have that document with the positioning and a very clear set of instructions of, like, this is how you can use it on your homepage. This is how you can use it in your sales deck. This is how you can use it in your one pager, right? And so the asset you get is a tight set of messaging and a translation table that helps you create those core assets in it. And then you have consistent assets that are tied to that particular messaging strategy.
100%. And that becomes a little bit of an art as well as a science, because whenever you're taking strategic positioning and messaging and translating it into an actual asset, you got to understand the media, you got to understand the channel, and you got to understand how the audience is going to consume in that channel and that medium. And we know we're not experts in all of those. And this is why we've actually been like, we don't want to go do a deck and a campaign and a TikTok campaign and all that. It's just like, you need to go have people that are skilled in that, but it should be rooted in this definition of the audience and these key differentiators and how you do that. And so we stop short in our process of, like, the execution, because that's something that, frankly, we're not experts in. Like, you can't be experts in all that. We don't want to be a full service marketing agency.
I love it. Well, listen, I think it's working. Obviously, you guys are growing fast. You've been helping hundreds and hundreds of companies. In terms of your own entrepreneurial journey and building this business, what are some of the lessons that you learned in building your Fletch?
Yeah, I think there's really two things that come to mind. I think number one is just, there's so much you don't know. And this is maybe more specific to us trying to be productized and trying to stay really small and bootstrapping. So maybe not as much for the venture back folks, but you just got to figure out a bunch of stuff. I think Adam Robinson says it really well, is like, bootstrapping companies is equivalent to, like, the ultra athletes of the world. Mm-hmm. Where, like, you just have to be able to do it all. And to be candid,
put the mileage in.
It's not for everyone. Yeah. I mean, it's a ton of work, right? Like, some people have said, like, oh my God, you did this so fast. It's like, no, we've literally been grinding for years. And, like, what they don't see is truly the night and weekends figuring this stuff out and working through and putting in the work. Like, you just have to be willing to do that. And that was just a thing that, like, you think you're prepared for, but once you're in it and do it, it's like, oh my God, it's both awful and amazing at the same time. My wife can attest. Mm-hmm. Brutal days on calls all day, working through things, working through the night. And then, like, you get through it and you're like, that was freaking awesome because, like, the outcome is so good. So it's this weird addiction type thing.
Putting in the work. Yep. I love it.
And then the second one, I think, is just, like, you really do just have to nail a problem. And I think, and it can be a moving target. And when you feel it, it's incredible. When you don't have it, it's scary. And I just think being, like, really realistic with that. When I tie this into, like, and I know we talked a little bit about this, like, how would I approach that as a founder? Like, what would I do? I think it just leans into, like, do the work and stay consistent. Anytime, like, because there's kind of been ebbs and flows, you know, I try and take a week off here and there. Anytime I'm not, like, doing the work and I get in my head and overly strategic, everything's harder. when I ignore the outcomes that I'm trying to achieve and I just roll up to my desk and I'm just like, these are the things I have to do. I want to think through the problems. I want to help my clients right now. I want to create content. When I do the work, everything else truly takes care of itself. And so like these venture-backed founders, I think have this burden on them of like, they're constantly being asked to be future-focused, strategic, and worrying about all these things. And I think it makes them horrible at execution. And there are just rare breeds that can do both. And that's why I think you have to be really clear early on of like who, if you have co-founders, like who's going to own all that. Because if you share that, I just think the future stress of stuff is just going to slow down your execution to the point where it's just not going to work. And I've seen that play out in our business as well when we try and get overly strategic and think about the future.
It's a really interesting dynamic of one of the many challenges why being a founder and early stage executive is so difficult, but really well said. Hey, so if our audience wants to learn more, where can they go to learn more about what you guys do and how it works?
Yeah, LinkedIn's the place. So you nailed it in the intro. It's like the only channel we're focused on right now that might change here in the coming months as we're expanding a little bit. But yeah, follow me on LinkedIn, shoot me a DM. We have yet to automate anything. So up to date, like you will be messaging with me, although to be candid, it may be slightly delayed. There's a volume issue we're facing with LinkedIn. But that's the best way to get involved and join the conversation.
Awesome. Well, I love that. And then last question is, what are some of the most interesting books or podcasts or blogs that you're following that you might recommend to our listeners?
Yeah. So I would say big influential books. We'll start there. We talked Jeffrey Moore, like Crossing the Chasm, must read, a must reread, and a must reread. Like there's just so much in there.
Yeah. How many times do we reference it today?
Oh yeah. And Anthony and I will find ourselves like just rereading it every 6 to 9 months. It's just like, there's just gold in there. Like he really does nail it. We built a lot of our principles on top of that. I'm a big fan of Steve Blank and the stuff he's done with Four Steps to the Epiphany and Technology Entrepreneurship, him, as well as Discipline Entrepreneurship by, and I'm actually blanking on the author. Sorry, bud. And then if you're in the service business, Built to Sell is a must read for anybody in like consulting.
Love it.
You'll read it in like a day and a half. It's kind of a story in there, but it's perfect for folks who are struggling with the operational chaos of going after different markets and scaling. And it really challenges your thinking around productize. I also love all the stuff that 37 Signals, Jason Fried, and David Hoppenmeyer Hansen do. Like, so their book Rework, I think is just fantastic. It's another one. It's like fun to read and they really just... very practical stuff. From a podcast newsletter, some other folks I follow on LinkedIn pretty closely, Kyle Poyer, Emily Kramer, my co-founder, Anthony Pieri. Like we, as much as we work on the same thing, like getting a different perspective, like our content can be unique, even though like thesis wise, it's very driven together. And then podcasts, I love the ones that are just usually pulling out stories of startups going through go-to-market. I think First Rounds In Depth does this best. And Lenny is also pretty good, although sometimes he gets more into like larger company product stuff and not always on the startup realm. So you got to just like cherry pick a little bit. And then the last one, again, on the service side, check out The Two Bobs. And so David C. Baker and Blair Enns do a wonderful job. They've written about positioning and building service-based businesses. They've written a bunch of books that are also great. But we dip into that one for, they've got really tactical stuff around whether it's pricing or structuring or productize and how you do all of that in a service side. And they also have a business to support it, which is pretty killer.
That's fantastic. Awesome, Rob. Well, I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for sharing all this with us this morning, and look forward to staying in touch, working together in the future.
Likewise. Thanks for having me. This was such a fun.
Awesome. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you please follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast player? And we'd be grateful if you recommend it to a friend. If you'd like more resources on how to become a better leader in business, we invite you to visit us at growthelevated.com. We'll be back next week with more insight from another great tech leader. Thank you.